It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
I had to go about it, write it out, and find it myself. And there's some stories I can tell you.
This is the Final Word Cricket Podcast with Adam Collins, coming to you from the Oval in London. Today, a real treat. A conversation with a man who will need no introduction to our British listeners, Greg James. But for those of you not in the UK, Greg has been a major presence on the BBC for the better part of two decades, hosting the biggest breakfast radio show in the country since 2018. Within cricket, he's hosted international test series on the telly and helped front the marketing campaign for the 2019 Men's One Day World Cup. But it's through his Tailenders podcast with great friend of the pod, Felix White, and England superstar Jimmy Anderson, where he found his perfect home. It's appropriate this chat took place here, the ground where Greg grew up visiting every summer with his dad, Alan, the place where he developed an unbreakable bond with the game. In this chat, he explains how he fell in and out of love with playing without ever really leaving, and how this has turned into finding a place for it professionally with his podcast, but not so much of a place that it eats away at the boyhood joy that started it all. All told, a delightful guest and a wonderful fella. Before getting into it, two things. Firstly, our Lord's Taverners Edinburgh Marathon campaign is really heating up. Indeed, this time next month, we'll have 50 Final Word runners participating across those three races, the marathon, the half marathon, and the 10K. Our collective fundraising goal is £30,000. I thought it would be helpful here to give a sense of what that target means in real terms. So 30,000 quid can sustain and help run six Super Ones programs for an entire year. It can also run four wickets programs for a full year. Attending weekly cricket sessions can cost up to £373 per year on average. The Lord's Taverners provide these sessions to young people for absolutely nothing. And what this breaks down to in terms of what you might be willing to contribute, 40 quid could cover the cost of hiring a venue per week, or even £15 would allow one participant to attend a cricket session with the Lord's Tavs for a month. So don't wait, hop into the link in the show notes and help us reach our target. Greg's also been a great supporter of the Tavs over the years, so I'm sure he approves of this message. A shout out to Mark O'Connor in Melbourne, who's thrown $100 in the tin and said he would double it if it was read out on the podcast in the best tradition of telethons in Australia. That is not beneath me. So tell me what you've sent and what you've pledged, and we'll read it out on the podcast if you're willing to double it. Easily done. And last but certainly not least, a word for Westfield London and Westfield Stratford City, our primary partners. I won't dare to add to their brilliant copy, so here goes. For cricket fans, the seam is a near-present part of our lives. Jimmy wobbles his, Fred Truman lifted his with an egregiously long fingernail, and it's another word for your Graham Gooch. But at the Westfield Good Festival, this is none of these things. It's a company offering free alterations and repairs on clothes. If you've got some buttons that need sewing, sleeves that need shortening, or you need the Eddie Hemmings done on your strides, then come down and see what the seam is all about. They're also offering embroidery from a menu of existing designs, as well as names and initials, and it's all part of the Westfield Good Festival from the 3rd to the 6th of May at Westfield Stratford City. Visit goodfest.westfield.com for more info. That's, of course, all on their website as well, goodfest.westfield.com. Righto, on with the show. You're going to love this one. Here's Greg James. It's the Final Word Cricket Podcast. I'm Adam Collins. I'm sat at the Oval in South London. It's a lovely kind of morning, few clouds in the sky, sun beating through them, and sat across from me in the what was used to be the Peter May stand is the man who's actually the chairman of the Oval Invincibles, co-chairman, Greg James. We're watching Surrey enjoy a good morning. It's 49 for 4 as I as I begin our interview. You've just rode your bike down from the BBC. You love being at places like this, don't you?
This is my favourite cricket ground in the world, and maybe my favourite place just to be, I think, honestly, particularly when the sun's out. I mean, look at this. There's almost too many people here. Because it's a very special place, the Oval. Me and Felix, my fellow co-chair, we talk about it a lot, and we realise that actually as kids, me and him were here, but obviously didn't know each other. So we would have been sitting watching Surrey or England or whatever here as kids, and it's quite nice that we've both become really good mates in later life.
We've interviewed Felix at the Oval a couple of different times with his various creative projects, and we've been wanting to get you on. I think originally we were talking about your documentary you made with Sky a couple of years ago, which we'll come to later, but
yeah.
I thought if we anchor our conversation to cricket and we drift from there, we can't really go wrong.
But that's what singing the cricket is like, isn't it?
Yeah.
You start with the cricket and then all of life unfolds and you tell everyone your deepest, darkest secrets.
And part of that, like when I've sat with you here before, well, invariably at the cricket, your dad's been sat with us as well, Alan. Yeah. It feels like he is an enormous part of your cricketing story, the influence he has on you, the fact that you still bring him everywhere, it's lovely.
Yeah, well, he brought me everywhere. So it's nice to repay the favour and keep that going, because he got me into cricket, like his dad got him into cricket. And I was a Warwickshire fan because of my granddad to start off with. He was a Bear. And this place is, well, cricket, I mean, this place in particular is where he brought me first. And we used to sit up, we've always been Surrey members ever since I was about eight, so I was a junior member, and we would sit in the pavilion top, and I just remember those, they were the best days. I mean, that's not a unique experience. That happens to a lot of people who fall in love with this game. You just have, it's about the cricket, but it's about who you're with at the cricket and who gets you into it, and the feeling that a ground gives you, and this place will always be so special to me. And it's actually quite weird when I'm not here with him, because he first brought me here, and we'd take trips down to London, and I go, oh my god, this is it, is like, we've got 2 days at the test, this could not be any better. So yeah, it's nice to still bring him along to cricket stuff, and I've got him to thank for being completely and utterly obsessed with it.
I have that gratitude with my parents as well, especially my dad. We sometimes take the piss out of him on the podcast, for we used to leave things early, which was a source of deep frustration when I was a little boy.
But was that due to travel problems?
And often irrational travel, like, you know, travelling home from the MCG, half an hour in the car, doesn't matter an awful lot if we stay till the end. But still, like, now as a, you know, I'm nearly 40, and I really like respect how much graft that must have been for him, dragging along two little rat bags, I'm sure my brother and I were, to almost everything that was going.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, I haven't sort of had the experience of taking him to the cricket quite so much, because often I'm working at it, but I did get him sent to Lord's last year after our wedding with my brother.
Nice.
That was quite special that he was able to go. This for him is a bucket list thing. Him coming to Lord's feels like a noteworthy moment in his life.
Yeah. But I think watching any cricket always feels special at whatever level. I'll watch anything. I'll always sort of turn up to any village team, even just for 20 minutes, just to, I don't know, just to be near it. You sort of want to be near this game, don't you? If you're obsessed with it, that's why you have ended up working in it, why you changed your career, and you thought, oh my god, I want to be near this game, because it gives you so much. Not only is it fun to watch, but it's the people you meet and the memories that it gives you, but also just stupid memories. Like, I remember the only things we bring for in the call bag would really be yum yums and Pringles. So whenever we're here, Dad would always go, I've got the Pringles. So it's like, there's those little things that I don't know, they're the stupid little bits.
And that's the texture, doesn't it?
Yeah, of course. You've just got time. I remember you just spend so much quality time with people, and it's not always chatting, it's not always that, but you get a lot of time, and I think the luxury of that, it's even more magical now. The world is so quick and so busy that you can just come here on a Friday and just sit. There's nothing better than it.
You can, you know, benchmark different parts of your life.
Oh god,
where were you when the cricket was on? Where was the cricket where you were doing this? You know, whether you're listening to the radio, sat next to somebody.
Yeah,
that's actually often quite a nice silence, isn't it?
When
you're both listening to the radio at the same time, you're both tuned into the same conversation, while saying nothing between the pair of you.
Well, if you're brilliant friends with someone, or you've got an amazing closeness with someone, then that silence is supposed to happen, and is actually a great thing. because you don't have to fill every second, unlike us when we're broadcasting every second. But yeah, that's, I mean, Felix writes about that beautifully, how cricket just winds through everyone's life. Mm. And it's the thread that holds it all together, really, because no matter what anyone goes through, breakups, jobs, health problems, whatever it is, cricket's always there. And I always feel like I get reset. When I was excitedly cycling down here today thinking, I'm going to be reset. There was this amazing bit of writing. I can't remember who the person was now, but they said, when you're with nature, when you touch nature, you feel clean again. And you sort of do. It's like a nice reset watching cricket. And it's nice to chart me and my dad's relationship. And then I guess it's a friendship now. We're both old.
Yeah. No, I totally get that. I found that increasingly now with playing again and coming back to playing. And I have that boyish link to playing cricket, yeah, which I think I'd lost somewhere along the way. Maybe it's because I was working in cricket, or my body wasn't as nimble as it was when I was in my 20s or whatever it was. But now turning out and playing, you can't keep me off the cricket field. I know you play it as well. I think that for a lot of young people, yeah, when we came through watching a lot, it also meant playing until, I guess, the lights long here in the UK. You would have been playing till 10 o'clock at night, midsummer.
Yeah,
it's part of your experience as well.
Oh my God, yeah, Sundays. 20 overs after six. Some of the worst phrase you can ever hear. If you're knackered and you've got school the next day or work or whatever. 20 overs after six, is it? Oh, for fuck's sake, really? 20 more overs. But yeah, you can just, you while away the day. I loved playing. I really, really loved playing. But I think similar to you, I refound that boyish excitement for it. Maybe in my early to mid 20s, because I lost it a bit when I went to university. It just happens to a lot of people. You just, other things take over. I still watched it and watched the 2005 Ashes in my summer at university, so you'd have this whole summer to do nothing apart from put the TV in the garden and just sit there. But I remember falling out of love with it, with playing it, when I was about 17, because I did managed to get to the heady heights of Hertfordshire under 17s, whatever it was. And I just...
That's not nothing, by the way. I mean, the fact that you didn't play for your county, a minor county at a junior level, but it demonstrates that...
Thanks for qualifying it. You played for your county.
A minor county.
At a junior level.
A national county, they would now call it. But, you know, you would have an appreciation for the fact that cricket is fucking hard.
It's hard.
And I think a lot of people who work in the game... Not a lot, sorry, that's exaggerating it. Some people in the game don't always quite remember that doing what they're doing out there right now, the degree of difficulty for success is quite high.
I didn't want it to be hard, though. That's what I learned. And I wish I'd realised that quicker. And I didn't want to take it too seriously. And I didn't want it to be too hard. I really liked it. And so I've had a weird sort of, I mean, weird and also boring, but I was born in Bromley, so I'm from Kent. Then we moved to Essex when I was about 11. And then we moved to Hertfordshire when I was about 14. So I've done the Kent, Essex, Surrey, a little bit of Hertfordshire journey.
Yeah.
But Surrey's always been the place that we've come to, especially when we were down in Bromley. It was just easy to get here. And then when I was at school, I was like, this is great. I was quite good. And I was really good until I was 17. Then everyone was better than me. Then I couldn't mentally deal with it. I was like, this is not fun anymore, because everyone's being really, it's too pro for me. And I just got completely overawed by it. I remember it vividly. I remember, because I was basically the only kid from my school that got a trial, and the team was made up of, and it was made up of a lot of kids from public schools in Hertfordshire, and there's some really good ones with amazing facilities. And by the way, this is not me saying I was dragged up, but I didn't go to a posh school, but all the public schools had about three or four, maybe five players that would all be in a group. And I just remember feeling so left out of my favourite thing that it made me really sad, and my head completely went. And that was a moment I thought, it's not fun anymore because I'm not in the gang. And I wasn't a big enough personality to force myself into the gang. I think I'm one of those people that's only comfortable being part of it, being loud, or, you know, confident when I feel part of the gang, and I just really didn't. And I then refound that with village cricket in my mid-20s, I think.
Right. Do you still get that? I mean, that reflection there about how you felt in relation to kids with different schooling. There is a serious point underneath all that, right? The ICEC report went to this last year, that there is deeply better than within English cricket, there's a classism which the game needs to try and find a way to break the shackles of through lots of different things, but yeah. At some level you can identify with that. It's interesting.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I definitely can. I felt left out of the trials, and I didn't feel like my facilities were good enough at the school, or my kit wasn't quite good enough, or whatever it was. I didn't fit in with that gang. But that's just teenage boys as well. Yeah. You know, I wasn't particularly confident. My technique was flawed, and I just didn't have that edge that I think I've got much more in my actual job that I chose to do, which I think is totally fine. It all worked out. I think I've got a competitiveness and a confidence doing the job I do now that I never had when I was playing sport. So I think it's all landed all right, because I still love the game, and I love watching brilliant people play it. I take a lot of joy out of that. I don't need to play it, unlike you. Because when we sat with you a few weeks ago, you were telling me about like new deliveries you were working on, which I love, because you've still got the hunger for it.
It sounds like something I would say.
Yeah, but you're right. The state school thing is interesting. I mean, Jimmy Anderson, famously like a big poster boy for state school cricket. But he didn't play cricket at state school. He had to go to a club. He went to Burnley. And I'm very grateful to all those amazing clubs that I played for. High Roding was an amazing club in Essex that I spent a lot of my years playing cricket for, and I loved it. And mum and dad would always drive me out to this little village in Essex to play for High Roding, and I loved that. And I got to learn about all the Essex villages and all the Essex teams and playing around Chelmsford and all of that, and that was really fun until it wasn't.
Do you still dream about running in and bowling quickly?
Yes.
I think that's quite a common thing from people that have drifted from the game, that they maybe don't wake up in a panic necessarily, but I know certainly with me, I still have those cricket-related dreams of being a much better player than I am now. But
you are a really good player though, aren't you? You are a really decent player.
But only in the context of games you're playing in now. I mean, like, for you, having played at the level you played at, and you know that idea of the wind being in your hair, top of your mark, maybe finding the outside edge, being caught at first slip, that's addictive, isn't it?
It is addictive, but also I think this is something we talk about on Tailenders quite a lot, is when things get tough in a test match or a high level game, I always say to Felix, I'd start crying. You know, if Virat Kohli was having a go at me from slip, I say to Phil, I'd cry. If Jimmy started having a go at me for missing a couple outside the off stump, I would crumble. And that is how I feel. I remember lots of great times playing cricket. And when you're in the flow and you've got the ball in your hand and it's just doing enough and it's just, you're landing it just right, or you're managing to move your feet and you can hit a glorious cover drive, or my favourite shot in the world, the straight drive, the on drive, then those are things you fantasise about. But I also remember the anxiety. And I think I was a very anxious kid. And I've managed to control that as a grown-up now, but I was very, very anxious, and I didn't realise it at the time, but looking back, I was, and I just was terrified of dropping a high catch if there was someone on the team who would have a go at me, and I would just be just devastated if I got out for naught. And also I remember the sort of horrible silence. That's the thing that I do remember, is that sometimes at the top of your mark, I just thought, I don't know if I can do this. I don't like hearing my footsteps going up to the crease, soft to begin with because you're on the grass. Then you get to the edge of the cut strip, and then you think, oh, it's got hard, and you can hear the click of the studs going into the actual wicket. And I really did overthink it a lot. And I think the best sports people underthink. I could never do that. I could never turn my brain off.
Right. Right, and I suppose you're drawn back to the game professionally as well, with your broadcasting career taking it off when you're a young lad, and you suddenly sat with Jimmy Anderson and Graham Swan making a program for Five Live.
Yeah.
And so that's, I guess, your first foray into having cricket as part of your professional diet, and becoming friends with a guy who, well, I guess it's an enduring friendship, your godfather to one of his kids, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Ruby. So, it's been a really unexpected treat getting to be in the cricketing world in some way, dipping a toe in and learning about this sport sort of from the other side, and meeting those players who you think of so highly. They are mythical beasts, and I still think that actually sometimes about Jimmy. When I see him bowling, it's not the same person that we have on the podcast, I don't think. But yeah, it's been an amazingly fortunate part of my life and my career that I got involved with that. And it was down to Jimmy and Swanee, actually. They knew that I was a cricket fan because I talked about it a lot on Radio 1 when they were listening to Radio 1 when I was sort of early days. And they had come up with the idea for this show called Not Just Cricket. And they didn't want a cricket pundit to do it. So they wanted someone else because it was not just cricket. So they wanted to talk about music because they're big music fans. They wanted to talk about comedy. They wanted to talk about The Office, Alan Partridge, whatever it was. So they honed in on me and I got this mad email. And I thought, well, obviously I'm saying yes to this. But I remember that. I remember that first show vividly. I'd not met either of them. We were in Salford to record it at Five Live, and I was in the studio, and Jimmy and Swanee walked in, both holding beers. Glenn Chappell was there. Sharky was there, who then became the producer of Tailenders. So Sharky's been with me since day one.
Okay.
So I've got a lifelong friendship with Sharky, the producer of Tailenders, who was there, and we just had this nervous meeting. We were all unsure of each other a bit because we didn't know each other. I knew them as these cricketers that I idolised. They were, you know, they were the guys, still are the guys. And I was there as a complete imposter. But I knew how to do radio. And I was like, right, well, I'm not the Jimmy Anderson or the Graham Swan of radio, but I do know more than them. And I know how to put a show together. And I thought, here's how we can tease out the stories. And I was just, I've just always been an observer of those people, I guess, and it's been such a joy.
It is a nice thing when you have, I find anyway, when commentating and having a new summariser next to you who might have just finished playing professional cricket, still be playing professional cricket, but with limited broadcasting experience, and suddenly you become the senior person in that relationship for, you know, 20 minutes or half an hour.
Yeah.
It's a weird flipping dynamic.
But that's the one of the things that holds Tailenders together, I think, is that we were all really interested in each other's jobs and specialisms, I guess. So Jimmy loves music. Wanted to be in a rock band, like wants to be a rock star. He also is obsessed with the idea of radio. He loves listening to the radio. He loves podcasts. He loves what it can do to someone's day, a good radio show or a good podcast. He loves that community. Oh, lovely. Lovely ball.
They're running through them here, 55 for five.
Oof.
This won't date very well, but that's okay. All part of the fun.
Score updates as and when we get them. So what was I saying? Yeah, Jimmy loves what a podcast community can be as well. And that's interesting to open him up to his fans. And he sees not only people in the crowd going, oh, Jimmy, but actually reads lovely detailed stories, which reminds him of why he loved cricket. Mm-hmm. So it's all a really lovely thing to be part of, because I guess we all let each other do our thing on the show.
Yeah, that makes sense, and that might explain to a point your kinship with Jimmy specifically. I get it with Fee, by the way. I mean, Felix might be the kindest, most giving person I've ever known in my life.
Yeah.
Like, you can't find a better friend than him.
No, that's true.
But Jimmy has got sharper edges.
He has.
He is caustic at times.
Yeah.
He's quirky. He's, you know, and you're also a very giving, loving, kind of charitable kind of guy. So there are differences between you and him, but you found common ground and found a bond that, as I say, has led towards him trusting you to be the godfather of his daughter.
Mm. Well, it's cricket, and we have a similar sense of humour. We like the same comedies. We would exchange music stuff. But the thing about Jimmy is that he is also incredibly kind. Mm. He's a very, very kind, generous man, and he's also very empathetic. And not when he's playing. He's a complete machine when he's doing a test match.
I suppose that's partly the image you get, right? Like, I've worked with him, but also you see the Jimmy on the field. You're getting a different side to him.
Yeah, you do. And if you're let in, and I think if he trusts you, but I think it's like a lot of people. I understand Jimmy to a certain extent. Not when he's playing. I don't understand that Jimmy. We can get onto that another time or later. But I understand the real Jimmy, because there is a shyness to him. And there is sometimes a lack of confidence, maybe in a social situation, or maybe when we're doing an interview bit on a podcast. He won't have all that. He won't have the same skill set that he does when he's running in and bowling to people. He doesn't have the same thing. And I understand that, because he feels really at home and confident and king of the castle when he's playing cricket. But I relate to that with him. But he is an incredibly thoughtful man. He's got a really good relationship with my dad, and similar that I have with Michael, his dad. That there's obviously he sees that we mean it. You know, if cricket fans turn up for years and years and years, you mean it, don't you? And he understands that I love the game in different ways to he does, but with the same level of depth. But just an example of how nice he is, my dad was raising some money for a new pavilion at Bishop Stortford Cricket Club a few years ago, maybe 10 years ago or so. And it was the day before the Oval Test. I want to say 2013, maybe. And my dad was messaging me the week before saying, "Be really great if you could come and open this. Do you want to come and open the pavilion?" Mm. I was like, "Yeah, I can do, because I played a lot of cricket there, and it'd be nice maybe to go back." And a couple of people would be like, "Oh, cool, nice to see you, Greg," whatever. But it's not that special, because me turning up to Stortford Cricket Club is like, "Oh, you're back, are you?" But I just said, "Well, maybe I'll ask Jimmy and see what he's up to, because I think he's in London." And it was an immediate yes. Nothing in it for him.
Yep.
Like, it was sort of before viral stuff, really. It wasn't like, "Oh, we'll do this for TikTok and it's going to go viral." You know, Jimmy Anderson opens pavilion in shitty pavilion on the second team pitch in Stortford. Not that it's a shitty pavilion, by the way, but, you know, it's not like...
Yeah, yeah.
It's not like he's opening a new fucking stand at Lord's, whatever. So he just said, "Yeah, all right. Yeah, all right, yeah. Put me up in the morning." So I drove to his... They were playing at the Oval because they were staying at Tower Bridge, some hotel there. Drove to pick him up. Drove him out to out in the M11, out to Bishop Stortford. No questions asked. No sort of like, "Oh, why am I fucking doing this? Why am I said yes to this?" He was like, "Yeah, this would be nice." Met all the juniors that turned up. They couldn't fucking believe it.
Yeah.
His kids were just like, "Oh, sorry. Is that actually Jim? Why is he here?" It was like the David Brent, "What are you doing here?" And they were really pleased to see him. And it was a ridiculous thing. It was a ridiculous. And then I just drove him back to the Oval, basically, because he had practice for the test match the next day. Mm. So he loves the sport. He still hasn't ever lost that love of it, and realises what it does to, what it can do to people's lives if they fall in love with it like he has.
And I think it comes through on the podcast as well, that when you and Fee slip into like fan mode as opposed to broadcaster mode, you're like, "Wow, this thing that happened that made me feel this way," and he's like, "Oh yeah, yeah. And he can kind of get into it as well. He identifies with it.
Yeah,
despite being a hardened pro 20 plus years, he still gets where you're coming from.
He takes the piss out of us a lot for being too nerdy sometimes and asking him really in the weeds questions, but he loves it. He really does love it, and he will never admit to how much of a badger he is. But he thinks about it all the time. That's why he's still doing it.
It's part of being a pro, isn't it? Pro cricketers invariably judge those who are too badgery, but they're really badgery themselves.
Yeah,
they don't like to give it off, though.
Because he thinks it's not cool to be a badger.
Yep.
Whereas I do. And that's where me and him differ. But it's that he wouldn't still be playing if he didn't love it. And yes, he worries. He will worry about what is next. Not because he's worried about what's next, but because he just loves doing what he's doing now. And that's why he got into it. And one of the things that's amazing about him is I don't think he's ever really forgotten why he's doing it. And I think that happens to a lot of people in lots of careers. You actually get to the point where you go, I've lost sight of why do I run in every time? And the reason he runs in every time is because he fucking loves it. He loves it so much. And it's really inspirational to see.
Yeah, that it might be repetitive, it might be the same process thousands and thousands of times, but perfecting it.
And he's not doing it for records, accolades, you know, being a sir. He's not doing it for money, really. The money's great. The house that Wicket's built is fantastic. But he really isn't doing it for that, and he doesn't really like being famous. You've got to see him with his fans. He's awkward with them. Me and Felix have to be the good cop, and he's the bad cop. We're all like, "Hey, yeah, you listen to the podcast." And he was like, "Yeah, let's have a selfie, all right? Fuck off."
Hi, I'm Isha Gua, and you're listening to The Final Word with Adam Collins and Jeff Levin.
There's a moment in your career where I suppose it could go either way with you and cricket. You look back at it some years later, zoomed out objectively, like you go into TV presenting in cricket, right? When BT get the rights and it moves away in the overseas. So it was a couple of winters of sitting in a studio through the night. Mm. You could easily see a world where that one thing leads to another and that ends up being what you do. But you choose to hit pause at that point. Just talk us through that experience of being an international sort of TV presenter on Test cricket.
Well, it was too good to say no to, to at least try out. And I really did enjoy it. It was, BT Sport 2016, they went into the cricket game with the rights. The rights was for Australian for Australia's home series.
Right, yeah.
And eventually the plan was they were going to do that a couple of years before, and then it would be the Ashes 17-18, right? Was that right? 17-18?
Yep,
yeah. So they started in 2016, they were like, stick with us for a bit and, you know, we'll send you to the Ashes if it goes well. And I thought, oh, that sounds amazing. I'd always watched the great anchors ever, you know, from Tony Lewis when I was a kid through Richie and Mark Nicholas and all the rest of it, and thought, wow, that's the job, isn't it? That is the job. And I really enjoyed learning it, and the live TV experience is like nothing else. When you're in a sad studio in Stratford in the middle of the night in December trying to hold together a live broadcast which is being beamed from Australia, you do the night shift and then you have 5 minutes and then you start the highlight show when you're at your most tired.
Yeah.
It was the toughest gig I've ever done.
Right.
But fascinating, and I'll always look back fondly sitting next to Michael Vaughan, Marcus North, who I love dearly and still chat to him every now and then, great man, and Ricky Ponting. And I got to sit and watch hours of cricket on a big screen in Stratford's BT Sports studio with Ricky Ponting, basically calling everything 5 minutes before it happened. I've never been next to a cricket brain like it.
Quite the party trick he has on commentary, isn't it?
It's just, he sees the game in a very different way to anyone else, I think. Yep. And he talks about batting in the box, in the cube, which he imagines, and everything is played from that box. And he talked about that when he was doing a demonstration. I just remember Michael Vaughan, we had this little net set up in the studio, and Michael Vaughan went, oh, I just don't understand that at all. I do not understand what you're talking about. Because it's this different universe they live in. But that was really, really fun. And then I did 40 nights, really, counted them, 40 nights of cricket, and realised that I didn't really love being an anchor like that, because it formalised this thing that I loved, I guess sounds a bit cheesy to say a pure way, but I quite liked being an outsider to the game, and you suddenly were very much an insider having to do the cricket and do the maths and note every score, but every score down, and think about what that meant in the context of the series. And actually it turned it into homework for me too much, which I loved doing as a sort of process of like, fucking hell, I've got to really be good at this. I've got to really be on it. So I loved the presentation bit of it and keeping the conversation going. So I took so many skills out of it. But fundamentally, I realized that if I want to do this properly, something else would have to go, and I'd have to really commit to it and be very, very good, because there were lots of people who are amazing at it and better than me at it. So I thought, no, I'm already doing this other thing which I've spent my whole life preparing for, getting good at. So I didn't want to spread myself too thinly, to be quite honest with you. And that's where Tailenders came from, because I thought, well, I want to do something crickety, but what is it? What's my version of it? What's the thing? And not just cricket was a great start, and then Tailenders was sort of the response to doing the BT Sport thing. And I thought, well, I want to do it on my terms. I don't want to have to be at every day of the cricket, because I can't be because of my other job on the radio. And that's how it happened.
It also feels like that little boy, you know, you as Greg the kid running around the cricket club 20 overs after 6 p.m, etc. It does chip away at that little kid too, if your job is the cricket. And I can speak from experience on this. I don't have the same relationship with the game. I'm still very passionate about cricket, love it in all sorts of ways, but it has evolved across the 10 years I've been in the cricket media. And I mean,
how do you keep the love? How do you dive back in?
I think playing has been a huge part of it in the last few years, but there would have been times when I would have struggled a little bit when working in the game to have maintained the enthusiasm for each day.
That's
like any job after a time, isn't it?
Absolutely.
You've got to treat it with the professionalism that it deserves. And you see a lot of players who talk about that. We would kill for the opportunities they've got, and they still see it kind of as a job. And with you, you know, having that toe in the water, as you described it with BT, then Tailenders, but then like the 100 rocks up, and I think the working assumption from everyone was that, oh, well, that'll be Greg James's next thing. He'll go off and be the presenter of the 100. You said to me at one point, no, I won't. There's no way I'm doing that, because you'd formed the view that you didn't want to have these two streams of your life being too interconnected. You wanted to keep a healthy distance.
Definitely. Another wicket.
64 for six.
Wow. Yeah, that's true. The 100 Yeah, that's absolutely. I mean, that's absolutely true. And also, I was doing the radio and breakfast show at that time, which, for listeners who won't know, is a 5 day a week commitment, and it is 5 a.m. get ups, and it is, you have to be on the money at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I just couldn't envisage something would give, and I'd be shit at that, or I wouldn't be able to be good at launching the 100. And I know how much effort and energy a launch thing takes. You'd have to really do it, and I was going to do it at one point, and I had good chats with Isha, and we went out for a coffee, and I just said, it's not that I don't want to do it with you, I just can't do it with you. And I also remember that voice in my head going, remember BT,
yeah,
remember what you thought, so don't be flattered into these things. And it is lovely to be offered these things, and I hope it doesn't ever come across as ungrateful, because being a cricket broadcaster or a cricket anchor, if I wasn't already doing my dream job, would be my dream job. But I'm very lucky that I did get to do my actual other dream job, which was do Radio 1 and do the breakfast show. So really, it was a very difficult choice, because of course I would love to have dedicated my time to being a brilliant cricket anchor, and that might have come off, or it might not have done, but I'll never know at this stage. But yeah, that was definitely a response. You're right, it was a response to the BT thing, and also not making it too much my job. I think that was it, because I would worry. I've made a lot of my favourite things into work, radio being one of them, and I didn't want to make this too much my job, I think.
And I suppose alongside that, you know, what I've referred to it for is the tail enderisation of cricket. Like, you know, the ECB have really leaned into tail enders, right? I mean, the 100 was the relationship you've got with that tournament, and the way that, I mean, you personally have been able to reach a bit of a new audience for them. We always talk about the new audience in English cricket. Gosh, how many podcasts have we devoted to the new audience in English cricket that needs to be found? But in its own way, you've done that, right? There have been Greg fans who've been brought into our orbit.
Yeah.
Indeed, some have gone on to, I think I'm right in saying, something like work in cricket, and they wouldn't have had a way in if not for tail enders and through you and all the rest of it. I guess there's a responsibility for you with that, but pride too?
Massively. Yeah, a responsibility. Definitely a responsibility when you've got a platform where you can tell people about a cool thing they might like. I think that's my Radio 1 training, which is demystify stuff.
Yep.
And I guess that is sort of a thread through a lot of the things I do for work, which is welcome people in and say, here's why I love this thing. Here's why you might like it. Come and watch a day. Come and just get to know this player. Watch this video. Watch this best of Shane Warne.
Yeah.
Like, just tell me why you wouldn't fall in love with this guy. Like, just watch it, and don't be scared by it. Don't be overawed by it. I think the other thing just to add is that, again, there are loads of people better at cricket broadcasting than me, and that's why also I didn't want to get in the way of it, because Isha does it amazingly on her own. Didn't need a co-host, and I thought, well, I didn't know what I could add to it, but I think I know what I can add to the game with tail enders, and that community of listeners has been one of the best things I've done with my life. I think, like, becoming mates with everyone who's on tail enders, matching Jimmy, Felix, and Sharky, we are the best of friends, really, and getting to show off this game to a new audience, you know, partly new. I think Tail Enders has played a small part in it. There's lots of other brilliant podcasts, but it's like an entry point, isn't it? All you need is a gateway. My gateway was luckily my dad, who said, watch this, do you want to come to the Oval for a day? I went, yeah, all right. And I remember him saying, and we did it at the same at Lord's, actually. We used to go and watch the Benson and Hedges and the NatWest finals when Warwickshire were in it in the mid-90s. And he'd say, you know, you're not going to be able to hear the commentary in the ground. I go, yeah, I think it'll be all right. And my sister was sort of on hand to pick me up if I needed to, if I just got bored. But you just need you need somebody to go, what about this thing? And I like that as my role. If I've got that if I have a role, I quite like guiding people towards things they might like, I guess.
You become quite proud of your audience, don't you? Like when Jeff and I in our more earnest moments. I mean, that's what we're most proud of with The Final Word, right? We get to do interesting things, and it's become our job over time. But it's the extraordinary friends that we've made as hosts, who you wouldn't automatically assume that in a traditional broadcast media environment. Or historically, it would have been the case that there was a natural division between the people who were talking into the microphones and the people listening on radio or watching on television. But podcasting has demystified that as well. Like, we all kind of become part of each other's lives.
Yeah, but that's why radio is the greatest thing ever. My love of cricket and radio basically happened at the same time. And it is, as a lot of people say, TMS was the first thing they maybe ever heard on the radio, and there's no music attached to it apart from the amazing theme tune, but that community is very special. The community of TMS listeners, the shorthand that the listeners have with the presenters, the same is true of cricket podcasts as well, because cricket is a game based around community, community spirit, fans, tribalism, but team bonding, friendships, all of those things. So I'm not surprised that cricket podcasts have those sorts of followings, because we are desperate for connection. And as I said at the start of this, when you're feeling low and you're feeling lonely or scared or sad or ill, then this amazing game is here for you, and the people who make it up are also there for you in terms of a cricket podcast, even if it's something as silly as that. So it's really, honestly, the greatest joy of my life that I've managed to marry up radio and cricket and sort of make friends through it. I'll never not be immensely proud of it.
A question I often get asked is, does my wife Rach care about cricket? To which she really doesn't, although to be fair, she does listen to Tailenders. Because of course she's a great, you know, she'd be the sort of person who would listen to Tailenders.
Yeah,
right?
Perfect.
Like, she dips in and out, knows what I do, has no interest in my show, but, be that as it may. But how is it with you at home with Bella? Like, to what extent does she care about, you know, this cricket thing you do?
Very, very little.
Very little.
Yeah. I also think that's healthy. I think it's healthy that Rach doesn't listen to your stuff.
Yeah.
Bella doesn't listen to The Breakfast Show. She doesn't listen to Tailenders, apart from when we had Michael Palin on, which is fine.
That's great. Totally
fine.
Yeah.
She loves the idea of it.
Yeah.
She loves that I love it. She will roll her eyes when I'll say I'm going for day four. She goes, sorry, you've got to look after your fucking dog.
What you're saying, this is a rare weekend day we have together and you're choosing to spend 7 hours at the cricket, that kind of thing.
I don't think it's even, because she loves doing her own thing anyway, and it's not that, it's just that she doesn't, just some people just don't understand it.
Yeah.
And I also understand why you wouldn't understand it. I think if you truly love something, you understand why other people would hate it or not get it, and I do understand why people don't like cricket, but my life's mission is to try and make everyone like it as much as me. But no, Bella's got a healthy relationship with my work, and I think I have with hers, although I'm a big fan of her writing. Mm. I really do love her writing, but her job's not as loud as mine, and that's something that I do worry about a lot, because my job is very loud in the house, and my tiredness and my mood, it can sort of put a cloud over the house. So I do try and keep it as separate as I possibly can. I'm very mindful of that I'm constantly working on stuff, but it gives me so much energy, and I think it's good for me because I'm enjoying it, and I get a lot of energy from other people, and I love it all so much. But she's really good, like, she's really close with Felix, which is lovely, and she is as close as she can get to Jimmy, because Jimmy's are all of our absent older brothers, really, who comes back from uni every now and then with a cool story. That's what Jimmy is. But she's really close with Felix, and that's a lovely friendship that's blossomed. And she gets Tailenders, and she comes to the live shows, and she sees the cricket pantomime, and she sees what it is, I think, and obviously has an appreciation of radio stuff, and she'll not come and sit with me at the cricket, though. That's okay. You've got to have different things that you're interested in.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if Rach was immersed in cricket, we probably wouldn't be together, you know.
I think that's true.
I think it's
dangerous if you do the same thing.
Yeah.
Isn't it? I worry about actors that do the same thing, or if you're both writers or musicians, that is quite tough.
Hi, I'm Matt Renshaw, and you're listening to the Final Word podcast.
Interested always in people with high profile jobs like yours, and, you know, we're talking a lot about cricket, but your day job is one where you talk to millions of people in a given week with the Radio 1 Breakfast Show and your other TV commitments and all the rest of it, who have stage names like you do with Greg James.
Yes.
Like, how often are you Greg Millward these days? Like, how often, you know, do you get much of a chat, or have they merged completely over the years?
I'm not. I've been Greg James longer than I haven't, I think, because it started, it's funny, I'm writing about this at the minute. I'm actually writing a book, which is going to come out next year, And I wrote a chapter on this. It's one of the first chapters, because I've never really talked about it much publicly, not for any other reason apart from it never really comes up. But when I was writing this bit, I thought, where did it start? And I remember that it started as a joke on student radio. And my mate Dave Bradshaw, who was the station manager of Livewire 1350 AM at the University of East Anglia student radio station, there was a form that I had to fill out. And he said, it just said, name, type of show, what sort of songs would you play? And this was to get a show. And I'd sat with him and I said, I need, my name's shit. My surname is not a Radio 1 name.
Right.
It's not a showbiz name, Millwood. It's not. It's the name of a head teacher, which my
your
dad
is,
was.
Right?
Yeah. I was like, it's the name of a deputy head teacher who then became a head teacher. It's not a Radio 1 name. So I said, well, he was like, what's your middle name? I was like, James. He went, yeah, do that. Greg James, Scott Mills, Sarah Cox, Chris Moyles. It's just like, it's a sort of... And then Radio 1 spotted me through student radio and I won an award, which was sponsored by Radio 1. And on the award, it said Greg James. And then part of the prize was to do an hour's show when I was at university. It was like a middle of the night pre-recorded show. And in the Radio Times, Greg James. I was like, well, that's it.
If it's in print, that's it. In the Radio Times.
That's it. We're just
that's how Test Special started, right?
What's that?
On the front of the Radio Times in 57 before the Birmingham Test match, the first ball by ball.
Right.
Because in 56, Laker takes his 19 in the match. They didn't get all of it live on radio.
Right.
So they made a dedicated effort in 57. And on the front cover of the Radio Times, it just said Test Match Special.
Oh, it was a special
program.
Special for the, yeah.
And that's how the rest is history, right?
You see, that's...
These things in life.
That's quite fun. And it does make me laugh that that's not me. But I think it helps as well in my job a little bit to have a little bit of distinction, which is why it's a great question. I don't really get asked it much. But yeah, on my passport, on my bank statements, it's Millwood. But I find it quite funny now having both. Mm. There was a time when I was sort of uncomfortable with it. I was like, fuck, I should have... Why have I done this? Why have I chosen a completely different name? But I think it's quite fun now. Yeah. But all the old score books from school and stuff would be Millwood.
Of course, yeah. I mean, if you played a game on a Saturday, yeah. You would be...
Oh,
you
know. I wonder what a therapist would say about it. I don't know. Maybe it's best not to overthink. Because I think, honestly... When I was 17, 18, going to university, is when I thought least about stuff. I was just totally focused on being on the radio. I was like, I know I can do this. I know I could get to Radio 1 one day if I worked really hard. I just had this feeling. I remember just this weird supreme confidence. I was like, yeah, change my fucking name. I'm gonna be a star. So it's very strange looking back at it.
Some of the best interviews we've done on this, people have compared to therapy sessions. So, you know, that's kind of been that tradition.
But maybe there probably is. I mean, COD therapy, there's something in the dividing line, being like, I was Greg Millwood before that. I'm now starting a new thing. I want to take this seriously. And I really did take student radio very seriously. I had such a laugh doing it. But I really cared about it and crafted those shows and thought about it and came up with ideas and made all the beds myself, did all the jingles, edited all this stuff. And I guess it focused me probably a little bit, and it was quite fun to have a stage persona. I've written about this recently, but if I could go back again, I wouldn't fucking choose James. Choose something more interesting. Choose like Greg Magic or no, whatever it might, do you know what I mean? Something better.
Someone's name over time becomes their brand and becomes their identity, right? So you couldn't be anything other than Greg James to your audience, but that's your internal dialogue, I suppose. Last crickety kind of question.
Yeah.
You're now the co-chairman of the Oval Invincibles, which, yes, I think you take as much joy taking the piss out of as actually doing. My
yes.
instinct is that. But
yes.
I mean, vaguely seriously, you were quite cynical and sceptical about the 100. I mean, you advanced, despite having had the relationship with the ECB, you went... I quite admire that, actually. From a journalistic perspective, you were still advancing questions about challenges that the 100 was going to present to the domestic game as well as the opportunities. And now you're actually ensconced within it. So again, that way you've been able to kind of walk both sides of the line a wee bit.
I think you have to be welcoming of stuff, but also appropriately sceptical of things. Because just going, oh yeah, let's just swallow this. This will be great. Like you have to have some critical thought
yep.
with everything. And I think when you work in the media, you also have to just check everything's as it. Like you just go, not everything is as it seems, surely. What does this actually mean? So you can't just be like, hey, yeah, this looks amazing, and take everything at face value. That's not the job of, that's not my job, really. It's, and definitely not your job as a journalist to go, yeah, I'm sure that's fine. You go, no, hang on, we've got to take the piss out of this a little bit.
Yep.
All these teams are sponsored by crisps. That's funny. Things can be both. It can be a really good thing for the game, but also it can be embarrassing and funny at the same time. And suddenly going, all right, so what are the rules? Have we got to... Oh, right, so it's five, is it now? Five balls and an over? Not an over. Oh, it's a set, is it? Okay, sure. Well, let's just completely... That is just funny. Mm. But whatever I think of the format, I mean, 100, fair enough. I'm still... I like what it's done. I really do like what it's done, and I've seen it, and I've been in the grounds, and I've seen my niece anecdotally, and that's one 16-year-old, but she's like, I like this, I like being here, I like the atmosphere, I like who's with me watching it, and I like how exciting it is, I like the fireworks, I like the kits, I like these players, and that's sort of enough. Again, it's gateway stuff. That's really where I came round to. I thought, well, look, it's like me sitting on Radio 1 saying, why are you listening to Ed Sheeran when there's 30,000 other brilliant singer-songwriters? It's great that anyone's listening to anything. It's great that anyone's taking note of any cricket. So I would never be snobby about anything new like that. But also, our style on Tailenders and the way I've approached anything in my life is to take the piss out of it, really. You have to, because otherwise you just turn into a propaganda machine. But yeah, I think you can still believe in the thing, but also realise that it's flawed. Like a lot of things, I believe in English cricket, but it's massively flawed. I believe in the game, it's massively flawed. I believe in cricketers, a lot of them are massively flawed. The world is massively flawed. And I'm a big believer in cricket being imperfect, because life's imperfect as well, and it's not always going to be right. Why do we hold cricket to such a high standard? And we're like, well, morally, that's the wrong thing to do. You know, the whole fucking Bairstow nonsense last summer. Brilliant. Fantastic, because life's a mess. Life is messy. People make bad decisions. People get it wrong. That's celebrated in the game. So there'll be things that we got that people got wrong in the 100, and they'll iron it out. And who knows if it'll stay as a 100 ball tournament forever? Maybe not. Maybe it turns into 20 overs. Maybe it is bought by some big companies. Maybe that could also be great. But being in the inside is really fun, because we're not paid by the 100. We're not on the payroll. But so we can still go, this is fucking stupid. But also, it's quite interesting to learn how a franchise team's put together. I love that. Our first board meeting, me and Fee, we sat up there in the, in our chairman's box. and which we're allowed one match a year. So it's not really ours. And the first bit of chat about them in the meeting was about kit sizes, delays on kit being delivered. Where are the women's team going to train? They're going to train at Beckenham. Who's booked that? Oh, we need to speak to the people who've booked it. Player welfare, immediately interesting to us, because that's a bit of the game we've never learnt about, which was loads of young players were playing suddenly in front of 100,000 people on Sky. So you've got 16-year-old girls, women, playing in front of a massive audience in the ground and on telly.
Well, you've got a duty of welfare. Care. Yeah, you've got a duty of care as a director.
Exactly. They drop a catch.
Yeah.
Suddenly people pile on Twitter, start having a go at them. They start having a go at what they look like, whatever it might be. You've got to have all that welfare stuff in place, and I find that really interesting. So that's the grown-up answer, is that it's been interesting. I understand why Rob Key went and did his job actually a bit more, because when I saw that happen a few summers ago, I thought, what the fuck, Rob Key
leaving the dream job?
But you're joking. The guy that they all take the piss out of on Sky is going to go and run cricket, and then you realise that you love this game so much, you all take the opportunity and go, yeah, all right, let's see what we can do. And me and Felix would love to do, just to make some little changes. We'd love to make our mark on that side or those sides.
Yeah, not letting progress be the enemy of perfection, or whatever the expression is. So having some contribution there. Mindful we're winding through to lunch, where I've got to jump back on commentary. So we'll start to move towards the end of our chat today, which is a shame, because we could talk all day, really.
I've chatted a lot, I'm sorry.
No, not at all. There's an old trope about Radio 1 DJs ending up on Radio 2 15 years later.
Or in prison.
one or the other. I mean, you made that mini-series documentary about the Alan Stanford debacle a few years ago, which was excellent television. You did a great job with that on the podcast as well. The Rewinder show you make on Radio 4.
Yeah.
I mean, you are kind of tilting in that direction as you reach the end of your 30s. I mean, 10 years' time, I'm sure you're still doing some version of Tailenders. I'm sure you're still involved in cricket. But
yeah,
as a human being, as a professional, is that where you kind of see yourself going when the Radio 1 road comes to an end for whatever reason?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one that I've battled with a lot, because I didn't think I'd still be there nearly 6 years on Breakfast. Not because of an age thing, but just because I thought I'd have had enough.
Be knackered. Getting up at 3 o'clock every
day. Yeah, I thought I'd be knackered, but I thought I'd have enough. But weirdly, yeah, my answer at the moment for the Radio 1 thing is I don't feel like I want to stop doing it for a while.
Great.
Because it's... And it's interesting, I've been at Radio 1 now since 2007, and I was 21 when I started, so you can do the maths on how old I am. But when I was 21 at Radio 1, I'll just say 38 was fucking old, and you wouldn't be there. But 38 isn't actually old anymore. I don't feel like an old 38, or whatever that's supposed to mean. But it's more of a mindset thing than anything else, that I still really care about new stuff. And I still am really interested in new artists, new films, new comedy, new ideas, new trends. I'm really interested in why people like certain things. And I still have that curiosity to find out the new thing. And that's sort of what Radio 1 has become, more than, hey guys, yeah, we're for 16-year-olds only. And because what is that now? What is a 16-year-old? Because a 16-year-old, actually, all the gaps have closed a bit, and a 16-year-old might like the same sort of thing that a 40-year-old might like, that a 10-year-old might like, that a 5-year-old might like, that a 22-year-old might like. And as long as I'm still plugged into it all, and I still don't feel exhausted by being plugged into it all, I want to keep going on it. And Radio 2 feels like too much of a leap for me, music-wise, content-wise, tonally. I love the tone of Radio 1. I love the spirit of the listeners. And I'd feel very sad not to have that every day, actually. So getting to do Radio 4 on the side is really interesting, because that's a different skill. It's a different audience, yes, but it's a different skill set. But really, there's nothing in the rest of the radio industry that gives me the stuff that Radio 1 gives me. So I don't want to hurry up and leave.
Well, be it on radio or with Tailenders or everything else that you're doing, Your enthusiasm and your spirit is contagious in the best possible way.
Thanks.
You make a great contribution to the game. You've been a terrific guest, Greg James. Thanks for being on The Final Word.
Oh, Colo, it's been a pleasure. Thanks. And as a long-term listener and fan and friend of yours, it's been nice. I'm glad that you could pin me down finally. Did we try and get this done in 2021? I'm sorry about that.
About right.
The pandemic was sad, and we were all quite sad, but thanks. It's been a pleasure. You know what I meant? I had to go about it.